You're listening to Pod for Ham, a podcast from The Incomparable that's all about the musical Hamilton, taking it one track at a time through the original Broadway cast recording. Every episode features different groups of interesting people talking about a single track. Visit us on the web at pod4ham.com or follow us on Twitter at pod4ham.
Welcome to Pod for Ham, the podcast where we're going through every single track on the Hamilton soundtrack. Lucky us and lucky you. I'm Andy Anatko, hosting this week, and joining us this week is Elsa Shumason Henry, Shannon Sutterth, and Aline Sims. This is going to be a bad one. this is going to be an ugly cry one. I've got not tissues, but a couple of paper towels near me because we are talking about Burn. This is the dramatic solo in which Hamilton's affair with Maria Reynolds has become public. Not just public, but Hamilton has published himself a 98-page pamphlet outlining the full details of his long-term affair with Maria Reynolds, and thus, by his mind, protecting his good name somehow. But this, of course, humiliates Eliza, breaks her heart, and also throws right in her face the huge, huge break of trust that such an act entails, and just how devastated she is, not just a private family thing, but also public knowledge. And in this song, Eliza spills out her pain, underscore the word pain, ultimately choosing to hurt Alexander where it counts by burning all of their personal letters, which she had meticulously saved, so that history would never ever learn from her own mouth if she ever forgave him or how it all played out. And ends with the line, "I hope that you burn." And I'm still just sort of cowering in a corner, even though these are words in an outline that from a fictional character to another fictional character. Elsa, why don't you start us off? What did you think about this one?
Well, as a historian, I hear this song and my heart breaks, and I want to like reach into the theater and go, "No, don't destroy all of the evidence, my God." So it's personally heartbreaking, but just sort of in terms of the show itself, it's stunningly heartbreaking and historically accurate to some degree, given that she did in fact get a letter saying that he was an Icarus who flew too close to the sun. Ow.
Shannon, how about you?
This particular song always jumped out at me. I love how Miranda was careful to give his leading ladies each sort of a different feel and a different voice musically. Angelica is the smart one, the quick-witted one, and she's the one who gets to rap. Then we've got Mariah Reynolds gets the smoky, seductive kind of song as she, you know, lures Hamilton into this mess. And Eliza is... her role is the most classic Broadway role, I would say, as far as she gets, you know, the upbeat songs in the first act. She gets the sort of longing, you know, stay, come, you know, be satisfied with what we have here kind of song towards the end of the first act. And here she gets to just stop the show cold with just a really powerful performance to start with grief and then work her way up into anger and then taking charge of her part in this history. This always just sort of leaves me gobsmacked every time I listen.
Yeah, it's hard to listen to this song and then get on with whatever your plans were for the next half hour. Aline, what were you thinking the first time you heard this?
the power. I think, you know, Philippa Sue has such a powerful, versatile voice, and her ability to deliver these lines is so astounding. I remember I actually listened to Hamilton the first time when I was doing housework. Like, I knew I'd be spending hours getting some stuff done. And I remember I was folding laundry and I just like stopped because it's just astounding. And it's beautiful and it's hard and it's soft all at the same time. Like, it's got these jabs, right? Toward the end, as her anger is building, it's like she's punching him with words, and that's all done musically. It's astounding. It's just beautiful.
Yeah, I'm looking at the final set of lyrics. I'm erasing myself from the narrative. Let future historians wonder how Eliza reacted when you broke her heart. You have torn it all apart. I'm watching it burn. The world has no right to my heart, no place in our bed. They don't get to know what I said. I'm burning the memories. I'm burning the letters that might have redeemed you. You forfeit all rights to my heart. You forfeit the place in our bed. You sleep in your office instead with only the memories of when you were mine. I hope that you burn. And this is the end of that song. And, you know, it was I had to listen to this song over and over and over again before I even, I think, fully was able to listen to it as the next part of the story or any part of the structure or even how beautifully and compelling the voice is. It's just a knife right to your gut because, I mean, it's like you kind of time travel back to, I don't know, like that moment in your teenage years where you thought it was going to be, mom is just going to be like, she's going to lose her mind if she finds out that instead of going right to the library, I decided to go see a movie with a couple of friends. It's nothing. I mean, she thinks that there are drug people who hang out there. We just want to see a movie. It's just going to hang out. It's going to be fine. So I'm just going to lie to her about that. It'll be fine. And then 3 days later, like she's found out and she gives you this talk. It's not a hand to the head, a hand to the face. It's, well, there, you know, four days ago, I trusted you and I thought that you had enough respect for me that if I asked you to do something, you promised me to do something, you were going to continue to do that. Now, I just don't know if I trust you anymore. And you're like, I wish I were dead right now. It's the response, not only being talked to like that, but also knowing that here is a person that I love more than anything else in the case of a spouse. And we had something incredibly special that I took for granted, and now that's gone. And I know there's no way of putting this back. And now I almost wish that I had confessed to embezzlement and abusing my role as Secretary of the Treasury, because I'd rather be in prison for the next 10 years with my public reputation destroyed if my wife Eliza is still going to visit me every single day and I'll see that same light in the back of her eyes every time she looks at me and I look at her. It's such a hard song to listen to.
It really, really is. It's tragic. And the thing that I feel really nails it is that there are points where he references other musical theater pieces in this song that make it even worse. If you ever listen to The Last 5 Years, that you is the exact same tone as the you, and I think it's Climbing Uphill.
Yeah, it's quoted. It's such an intricate musical. I don't know any of the references until I look at the Genius Notes and I see that, oh, he's quoting this here for this effect.
Yeah.
But that doesn't distract from just the effect of this. I want to ask you something though, Elsa. As a historian, like, would it have been normal for a woman to keep every scrap of correspondence? Obviously, we know what we know about, you know, John Adams and Abigail because of their correspondence. We know very little of I've read of Jefferson's personal life because those letters were kind of meticulously destroyed. If I have that correct, like, so what was it? Was it normal, or is it significant that someone would destroy papers? Or is it just significant that someone would really try to keep those papers?
I think it's significant in the context of her destroying those papers. I mean, I think that if we look at, say, Abigail Adams as sort of an example, she was really a steward for American history because of the way that she kept these letters meticulously. We have diaries from women in that era that were kept meticulously. We have information from household books. So I would say the fact that, you know, in the show, Eliza makes this choice to destroy these letters really is a historical meticulous choice to sort of not give Hamilton the legacy that he wants, that he craves. It is a punishment, and I think it's a just punishment in this context. But I think many women, including Abigail Adams, sort of at least probably knew somewhat that their correspondence would be historical.
Do you think that this was an emotional act, like, I'm so angry right now, I just want to make something or somebody hurt? Or do you think it was a cunning act, saying that, no, I know that this is the price that you have to pay. This is the price I'm going to exact from you.
I think it's both.
Yeah, I would agree with that, because she's, on the one hand, as she says in the story, she's taking charge of what she can. She can remove whatever she said with Hamilton from, you know, from future historians. She can take that chunk of knowledge out and control what is said about her better by burning these letters. And plus, yeah, she's burning. I mean, Alex Hamilton was a writer more than anything else, and she's burning stuff he wrote. So that's like hitting below the belt as hard as she can.
Yeah. And as I've said in previous episodes, Alexander was all about his legacy. And so by burning those letters, not only is she kind of burning a part of who he is as a writer, but she's also removing things from the historical record, whether, you know, that I imagine that would have been impactful to him.
Yeah, it really is impactful, the lines in which she kind of acknowledges that as a public figure. And also, I think she could recognize that Hamilton was destined to be a historical figure doing his role in the formation of a brand new country, that their lives weren't theirs alone, that they were going to belong to, maybe against her will, her life was going to be part of history. And I kind of have to wonder how she felt about that, and what she might have told the young girl that that first met. Was it Colonel Hamilton at that point, or was it still Major Hamilton?
No idea.
It's a big deal to sign up to become. I'm going to be married to somebody who's going to be on the $10 bill, which means that at some see the spoon that I'm just stirring my coffee with. At some point, this is going to be beautifully labeled and preserved in a glass case, even though it was just a crappy spoon that I found on the road 2 days ago and thought it was too good not to throw away.
Mm-hmm.
It really does make you think, for instance, about how it seems like a miracle that a scrap of paper would survive 200 years for future historians to look at. One of the reasons why the Chernov biography was so important is that at some point a historian has to do that really boring stuff to find out who had this set of papers from this ancillary character, and were they preserved, and which university, wherever in the world, it now receives them, and having to look at every single page of them.
And not only that, but who do you have to talk to get access to those papers? Who do you have to say, this is the research that I'm doing, this is why it's being used, this is how it's being used? It's not just that you get to walk into a library and look at 250-year-old pieces of paper. You actually have to prove that you need access to them.
Yeah.
As somebody who has spent a lot of time digging through various archives, I can tell you it is painstaking work, but it is very, very worth it when you find gems.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a historian. I'm doing one kind of research project that gets more and more intensive with each passing year. And you're making me think about how it's weird how important the weirdest, tiniest little scrap of paper can be. I'm looking for answers about the development of a certain piece of art that became really controversial in the 1890s. And I'm one of the big questions I'm trying to answer is, how did this particular artist feel? And as you say, you have to know who has what collection of papers, and then you have to say, well, yes, I write for the Chicago Sun-Times. Well, no, I'm not writing about this for the Chicago Sun-Times. I'm just writing. And somehow you manage to find yourself in a room wearing white gloves, allowed to like go through this box of documents that somebody conserved. And then in my case, I found a calling card from this artist's address that was just a random piece of paper that on the back of it simply had like an 8-word sentence that was the exact answer to the question that I was trying to ask. And it was not really like a big significant, yes, I killed him, and I killed him because he stole my father's land. It was just a simple bit of data. So it really does make you think about the slightest piece of paper that could be, that someone might have written down in 1798 that they thought nothing of. The fact that someone fished it out of the wastebasket, or somebody used it to reline a book and it appeared later on, can illustrate and solve a problem that's been on people's minds for 100 years.
So for me, it was sitting in a room in the stacks of a city archive. It's not even a public or a private library. And going through all of these address books. And I have to tell you, I mean, it's the kind of thing where you go, wow, why am I doing this? Except that I was documenting burlesque houses in the 1930s in New York.
And page after page after page of it. It kind of makes you think about all the documents and data that we're leaving behind because it's now digital and everything gets backed up in 4 places. I recently was doing like an audit of like my own mobile devices and discovered that every photo I take by my design was being now backed up in 5 different places. It was now almost impossible for me to lose a photo. Maybe historians now are going to kind of curse the fact that instead of, oh, I really, really wish that I had a picture of the inside of this sculptor's studio in 1893. Now it's like, which of these 10,000?
Right.
Let future historians wonder why that guy data dumped when he could have saved me time.
Hashtag. Just use hashtag, sir.
Organize your information.
That's kind of a semi-serious question, though. I know we're veering a little bit off of the content of this song and more into the context, but do you ever think about how these little pieces of information that you're leaving behind on a hard drive or even a scrap of paper you decided to keep for some weird sentimental reason, but now your great-grandchildren might have this, now that they have a thumb drive that has 81 million quadrobytes of storage that has there's no reason to throw away anything. One of the things that gets handed down is that everybody gets a copy of great-great-grandma Eileen's data bolus or whatever she left behind. after Google folds, they have to basically disgorge all the data back to their original owners. Like, does it ever concern you that maybe I should delete this even though it's harmless, or maybe I shouldn't save this scrap of paper or this photo because I don't want someone 100 years from now to not know the context that this came in?
I think about it a lot. I actually go back and delete tweets every once in a while where I'm like, you know, I'm involved with organizations like mentoring young kids. And I'm like, maybe that wasn't something, you know, like I used a curse word or something. So I'll go back and self-censor. Not always, but sometimes I do that. And yeah, I think about it a lot. Like, I have almost 30,000 tweets. I take pictures. I was in Philadelphia the other day. I took a bunch of pictures. I don't really post to Facebook so much, but you know, like podcasts, all of these podcasts that I've done and will do in the future, I think about what the impact of that may or may not be, especially when you're thinking about, you know, hopefully the human race is around in 300 or 400 years. I'm not confident it will be, but maybe it will be. And what is that going to be like for those people? Because they're going to have the opposite problem that we do now where, you know, as you were talking about, there's going to be an abundance of information. Whereas, you know, with writing the Hamilton biography and trying to piece things together and figure out what is factual and what is speculation and what was rumor is so difficult.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I have a weird sort of version of this, which is that my father passed away when I was very young, and I got all of his papers. All of them. So I have a mini archive in my house. And I do. I think about it a lot. I think about what he would have liked to have actually had me read. I wonder if there are things that he would have edited out if he had had the time. And so there, it's weird because I'm sifting through, like, personal correspondence. It's not just civil documents. It's not just things that sort of were left behind by the government, which is usually the kind of research I do. But this is, you know, personal documents. These are correspondence, letters. These are drafts of scripts that he wrote, and they're half finished. And so I think a lot about sort of what we leave behind, but also who we intend the audience to be. Because in many ways, I'm my father's historian, and I'm not sure that that's really what he intended.
Mm. Yeah, we get back to who lives, who dies, who tells your story. And you don't have to be Alexander Hamilton for that phrase to affect you.
I just keep going to the fact that Eliza felt like her only option was to erase, not lock away, not put somewhere else until such a time that she might want to pull it back out. But between her anger and her position as a woman at the time, you know, not equal to the husband in a relationship, anything like that, that the only agency she could take was erasure. That hurts.
Yeah. It's destruction, not I'm going. If it seems as though if she had simply withheld the letters, she would have retained some power because, well, I can restore this, you know, but I choose not to.
Well, and there's also that in the moment lashing out.
That's true. That feels very, you have a massive breakup and, you know, one of the first impulses you have is to, you know,
destroy it all.
Yeah. Throw away, burn, get it, purge it, get it all out of your life.
Yeah, we get back to was it an emotional act or was it a cunning act? And I don't mean that in the bad form of cunning, but there are times where you think that it would really make me feel good in this moment to do this thing. But what if I really, really want to solve a problem, or if I really, really want someone to understand through pain or suffering, how much pain and suffering they've inflicted upon me, here's something better that I can do. I'm not sure if the song is meant to answer that question.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Cunning, deliberate, I would say.
That's a better
more
that's
so
a better
than
word.
Just cunning.
Yeah.
But the amazing thing about this song is this is the first time we see Eliza with agency.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We don't, you know, it's all about, you know, Angelica early on, and then it's all about Alexander Hamilton in the middle, and then we see her as a mother, and this is the first time we see her doing a thing for her. Well, and exactly. To punish him, but that's also for her, you know? and there's such power in that, and I think that's why, beyond the passion of the delivery and the passion of the lyrics themselves, but just the passion of the act of it being her choice in a world where she didn't necessarily have a ton of choices is pretty amazing.
I think the other thing I love about what Miranda does in this song that just hit me, how Eliza's character, yes, she acts out of fury and hurt and pain, but you never lose sight of the fact in these lyrics that she's mad at Alexander. Mm-hmm. There is no shaming of Mariah. The only reference is this girl. There's no insult. There's no vindictiveness, even though history says that it may very well have been Mariah and her husband who plotted the whole thing in the first place. But Eliza zeroes in on Alexander's betrayal and nothing else. And I think that if Miranda had teetered over into turning Eliza into much more screaming angry at everybody, it would have been harder in the end for her to come back and become the keeper of his legacy in the final song the way she does.
Oh, that's a great point.
Does anybody know what do we have a different idea of what was expected in a marriage in the 18th century versus today? Was there a big difference, or was there still, hey, look, we are bonded and we are equal to each other, and we are, I'm sorry, not equal to each other, but we are basically bonded to each other for life, and I do not anticipate that you're going to stray from our bed.
Fidelity was very important for women because you needed to have paternity be guaranteed for an heir. I am not a sort of marriage with men is not my specialty. I hate to say, but I would argue that while men definitely did sort of step out on their women, it was certainly frowned upon.
Yeah, when I'm reading a lot about marriages, and I know this is an unusual example, but marriages among like successful artists in the late 19th century, and the thing I keep coming back to is that the husband was having lots and lots of affairs. The wife was okay with that, but as soon as he stopped being discreet about it, well, then you're trying to humiliate me, and that's when the marriage is over. And that's what sort of got me thinking that maybe I don't understand the difference between marriage throughout the centuries.
It's complicated.
Oh, Facebook, always with your thumb on the pulse of the emotional heartbeat of humanity.
Through the ages.
So what? Let's before we wind up, though, let's talk a little bit about the relationship to the characters. It's like it's like you look up from your seat in the living room, and you see that no, the highlighted bar through the track list indicates there's still several tracks left to this, and several of them involve Eliza. And yet after this song, after Burn, you don't imagine Eliza wanting to be within 100 feet of this person ever again, let alone sustaining a marriage. Where does the musical have room to go after this? Shannon, did that occur to you? It's hard to figure out how they piece this together.
I'm not sure I had time to think about it so much, because if I remember, is the very next track Blow Us All Away that brings the children, that Philip, into the play, which would be, of course, the link that, you know, Alexander and Eliza still have is their children.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure I had time to consider it.
It seems weird and maybe a little bit obtuse, but it seems as though, at least in the context of the musical, the thing that brought them back together was the death of their son. Because Eliza's Alexander, whatever Alexander has done, he's the only person who can understand what Eliza's going through at this moment.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, as listeners, we all know he's got to address the duel, right?
Yeah.
This show has to get to the duel. How does it get there? You know, who knows? But we know that that's got to be the end, or close to the end, because it would be odd if there's this play or this musical about Alexander Hamilton that kind of left that big event off.
You got to leave room for the sequel.
Oh, that's true. That's true.
$150 a ticket. You know, you got to make that money back somehow. I kind of wish I'd either not decided to read the book at all, or had decided to read the entire book before like hearing the soundtrack for the first time, because I keep like laying things into my understanding, or what I think I understand about the musical. And just part of me, at least dramatically, makes me think that maybe this is one of the reasons why he was kind of okay with going in for a duel. Because, look, a good 18% of me died with that first incident. For the Reynolds letters. And then another 14 to 40% died when I lost my son. It's not that I don't want to live, but I have so little left to lose at this point. I'm already on the downhill end of the log flume. Even though the book tries to build the case that he was a very, very old-fashioned, traditional person for whom the romance of meeting on the field of honor was a very, very big thing and a very, very potent thing to him. But I think that it almost feels like, of course, the Hamilton, the fictional character in the play, can do things for different reasons than the real Hamilton, or at least the Hamilton that was reconstructed by Chernov. Are we comfortable with the person that we think we know about, that we know is Hamilton at this point in the musical?
Well, so I haven't read the biography. I actually started it a couple of days ago. So a lot of what I know about Alexander Hamilton is because of the musical, and is very informed by that.
I bumped my head into this same problem as you, like with 1776, for instance, because as a little kid, that was kind of like my first introduction to any version of the founding of America, of the Declaration of Independence, that was not printed on like a Friendly's placemat, you know. And so it became very, very hard to displace a vision of John Adams that was not being portrayed by that movie. And so now I think that so many people, myself included, have this vision of Alexander Hamilton that's shaped by the narrative in this musical. And so the Hamilton that I know through the musical is like, at this point in the story, he's kind of all of his personality defects that were gonna destroy him have really put cracks in the foundation. And it's kind of hard to figure out at what point they're mimicking the real Hamilton and what point this is where the character has to be in order to get to the conclusion. I'm sorry if that doesn't make sense. It's I'm kind of expressing an unformed thought, I know.
No, it does. It really does.
There's a moment, again, I'm quoting the Hamilton documentary that just came out, but there's an interview between Lin-Manuel and Stephen Sondheim, which is great. But they talk specifically about the concept of writing about history and about how when you write a musical about history, there is a point at which you have to say, okay, I have all this research, but now I have to write the characters that make the musical. And I think it's really true because, yes, the Hamilton in Hamilton is the Hamilton in Hamilton. And he's the main character, so we're going to have specific feelings about him. But the Hamilton outside of the play is very different, and that's fine. And we get to have different opinions about him based on other sources of information.
Like I said, let's wind up with a more simple and maybe a little bit sensible round trip question. Forgetting what happens in the next the remainder of the soundtrack, how do we each feel about Hamilton at the end of this song? I think I alluded to my own feelings at the very beginning where. Yes, I can. It's you can't feel good about a person who made someone who is as nice as Eliza feel this terrible. But it's tempered with sympathy for the times where knowingly or unknowingly I've disappointed somebody else, either in reality or in my own mind. And knowing that this is not someone who worked out to do evil. This is somebody who just has a lot of personality limitations and. Someone just got caught in the crossfire. But it's I don't know how I feel about Alexander Hamilton at this point. It's like I feel as though a certain fuse that was lit during a hurricane in his teens is now really, really close to the powder at this point. And I'm just watching this thing burn and not even interested in pulling the fuse.
At this point in time, I am not a big fan of Hamilton. Mm-hmm. He built his own little house, and now he has to live in the house while it burns.
Yeah, I'm kind of the same. I don't have a lot of sympathy for him because he got to where he is at this point by making choices. And I am a big proponent of, you know, as Elsa said, you made this bed, now you lie in it. And that doesn't mean that I hate you forever or whatever, but there are consequences to the things you have done, and you need to deal with that.
Similarly, this is a low point for Alexander's character. Eliza has been shown throughout the story so far to be, you know, absolutely, totally in love with him. His steadfast supporter of his, trying her best to keep his feet on a steady path. You know, you need to take a break once in a while. Don't work so hard. All these sorts of things. This was the one person but in the background, as the politics were in the foreground through so much of this act. And he has just managed in trying to preserve his legacy and focusing on the wrong thing, his very foundation has been yanked out from under him, and she and Eliza is pulling no punches as she does it.
We feel pretty good about Eliza, as good as we felt about her before the show, before the song.
Mm-hmm. We understand.
Yeah.
I think there's no question that the audience is very sympathetic to her choices and her actions as she burns the letters and as she takes charge of what she can.
Absolutely. Well, this has been Pod for Ham. I've been saving up that ugly cry for the next 10 minutes. I'm good until we end the show. But before then, thank you for being part of the panel. I am, was, and will be Andy Notko. With us today was Elsa Shumason Henry. Elsa, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And Shannon Sutter. Thanks, Shannon.
Always a pleasure.
And finally, and in reverse alphabetical order, Eileen Sims. Thanks, Eileen.
Goodbye, and thank you so much.
Thank you, everybody. And this is a good reminder that if you ever have finished an ugly letter to a friend or a family member who disappointed you and left it on the hard drive 8 years ago, maybe it's a good time to revisit that and decide if you want to secure delete that before somebody winds up with your MacBook a year after you die. Cheers.